Good evening.
Good evening.
Our guest tonight is Tim Coquette, currently the advocate of the Minnesota Zen Center in Minneapolis. And Tim has been in Minneapolis 7 years. But his Zen practice didn't start there. His Zen practice started here.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Wonderful to be here. See all of you earnest Zen practitioners. Motivates me not to fall asleep too often on my cushion. I was, as Les says, I was at Stanford University. I was a junior, supposedly, at Stanford University. And I didn't know anything about Buddhism or Zen. I've been raised a Unitarian in Palo Alto. But I found a book, The Teachings of the Mystics by W.T. Stace. And in that book, there was a lot of description. Excuse me, I'm going to have a drink of water. A lot of description of experiences in all of the major spiritual traditions of a great stillness where the thinking mind is no longer the center of attention, where instead the center of attention is whatever is. And I was just taken by that. I couldn't believe it, that it was all in all the traditions in the world. At the core, as Houston Smith would say, that's the esoteric core of all the exoteric traditions. I'm looking at Les because I saw that Houston was gave the introduction to Les's last book, and Houston was a wonderful man. So instead of going to classes at Stanford, I started just reading this book over and over and over again. My poor dad, who paid for me to go to Stanford. over and over and over. And certain phrases I would read over. So I didn't know how to meditate. But I was kind of meditating without knowing how by reading the same phrases over and over. And I had then, after doing that for some time, a spontaneous falling away of all of these worries and concerns. Falling away of the identity of so-called Tim and his regretting and remembering and rehearsing and remembering and regretting and rehearsing, all that stuff fell away completely, and there was a deep peace. But that peace lasted actually about 3 days. It was wonderful. Then I was coming back on the train to school at Stanford, and Tim came back. He came back in and started chattering again, as if he ran the place or something. I would read actually the same phrases that I had been reading, and then the piece would come back. But by the time I got back to Stanford, I was just my usual wreck. So I thought, well, Zen, that's what's in that book. It's the one with the least accoutrements. Little did I know. It's the one that's the most direct, pointing to just this stillness that's always here in the midst of each activity. That's the one I want to try. So I and I thought, well, there's a huge Chinese population in San Francisco, Chinatown. There should be a Zen teacher there, right? If there's going to be one anywhere in the United States, he should be in Chinatown. So I went up to San Francisco, and I looked in the phone book under Z. I wasn't too dumb. I was a Stanford student, right? I looked under Z, and there was the Zen Bar and the Zen Center. Now I had a real problem. Which was I going to go to? The Zen Bar sounded pretty interesting, but actually, I knew the bar scene very, very well, better than I should have known it. But I was 20, what do you expect? And so instead I went to the Zen Center, and at that time it was very tiny. It was in a Jewish synagogue on Bush Street, and Suzuki just greeted me when I came up and showed me how to sit. So that was the beginning of my practice. So this book that I have here with me someplace, nothing holy about it, is made up of vignettes of my memories of Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, my second teacher, and Chino Roshi, who was also a teacher of mine. And woven into that are my teaching as a Zen teacher. And this was all done by Wanda Isle, my former student and now peer, because I don't know how to write a book. She just took all my talks for years and years and wove them together into something quite wonderful. Quite wonderful. So, I've been giving talks around this Northern California. It's been wonderful homecoming for me because I grew up here, although it's pre-Silicon Valley when I grew up. I have lots of stories about that, but I won't get into them. It's been wonderful. I've been visiting all of the Zen centers that I was part of as a young man. Tassajara, San Francisco Zen Center, going to Green Gulch, Berkeley Zen Center, on and on and on. It's great, great homecoming. But this is the most special homecoming. Because, as Les said, I have a relationship to you guys that you didn't even know about. You know, we have relationships to all beings, and we don't even know it. But if we really get still, we experience that relationship. And anyway, my relationship is that Suzuki once said to me, once in fall of '64, when I'd been practicing with him for 6 months. I'd like to start a group in Palo Alto. Would you help me? And when he said, would you help me, he meant, would you do it, right? So I said, okay. So I found some Stanford students, graduate students' house in the edge of campus. And he said, I'll come down the night before and I'll sleep on the couch. And he was already a little over 60, but he was willing to sleep on the couch. To just offer the Dharma to folks whose minds were out of control and needed respite, needed stillness. So he began coming down every week, although he didn't come down the night before and sleep on the couch. One of his students brought him down, and we had about three or four people sit every morning with me and him, and the graduate students would be asleep upstairs, and the house would be a mess. So we did our sitting, and Suzuki gave a little talk. He'd roll up his sleeves, and he'd get to work cleaning up the place. And I just followed suit. But then one day I said to him, you know, Sensei, we have to go to class in the morning. We can't stay and clean up these sloppy people's house. And he said, oh, well, then we'll start earlier. We'll start earlier. Oh, we started earlier. We started earlier. Although I said, no, 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 we don't need to start earlier. Classes aren't that important. He said, oh, classes are very important. So that's one story. Another story is one of the last talks I gave was San Francisco Zen Center, and I went to the old Zen Center on Bush Street, where was a Jewish synagogue that the Japanese owned, and Suzuki was their minister, and he was also our Zazen teacher. And they paid him. We didn't pay him anything. And it never occurred to us that to pay any money. I don't know. You know that what things were like then. Maybe you don't. Most of you are too young. But a few of you do. But every Saturday, we did Zazen. They didn't do Zazen with us in the second floor of the Jewish synagogue. And then on Saturday night, he would go to the movies in the big auditorium with them. These would be Class D Japanese shoot-up movies. Samurai, Blood and Guts. He went every Saturday morning. Then you have to give the talk on Sunday to us. And I would, instead of going to those movies, which didn't interest me at all, it just seemed stupid, I would go to North Beach to see, you know, good movies. So once I said to him, Sensei, you go to those movies every Saturday night. Do you ever like any of them? That must be a real burden for you. And you have to get up. He said, oh no, I like them all. So this spirit of I like them all. We see a lot of movies when we're sitting in Zazen, don't we? A lot of movies. Sometimes they're wonderful, sometimes they're awful, sometimes they're comic, sometimes they're tragic. But is it possible not to judge them, not to evaluate them, just to watch them, not to get on stage and argue with them and say they shouldn't be the way they are, but just be with them, just let them be as they are? They're just movies. So I had been having a really hard time in my Zen practice, watching these movies, sitting on this cushion, morning and night, day after day, the new movies in my mind, that is. So that teaching was very helpful to me. Although at first I thought, God, how can he like them all? Usually when he would say things like that, I would think, oh, he just doesn't understand my English. But then later I realized, oh yeah, he understood my English. He understood it just well enough to give me some support. And that was support. He was giving me support. So now I'm going to read another story. This story is about an experience I had after I was at Tassajara Zen Monastery. Raise your hand if you know about Tassajara Zen Monastery. Not all of you do. So Tassajara is the big monastery in Carmel Valley where Les practiced and I practiced and many of us are practicing. Still, we were just down there. I was speaking to them that Suzuki started. After an 8-week retreat at our monastery in Carmel Valley, which was named Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, I returned to San Francisco and immediately took a bus to the D. Young Museum. I was still in the afterglow of the long retreat. This was a 7-day sesshin. In a meditative state, I walked through the museum slowly, soaking it all in as I made my way to the Asian collection. When I came to the first Buddha statue, I stopped. Or rather, I was stopped by it, captivated by the peaceful expression that seemed to mirror what I was feeling inside. I felt an incredible stillness emanating from it. When I looked into the Buddha's eyes, they seemed to open into pure space. It felt as if I were teetering on the edge of something. Instinctively, I turned away. But just a few feet away, there was another statue. Its eyes were also like deep holes into no thingness. Again, I turned away. But the statues were everywhere. Infinitely vacant eyes were everywhere. I was overwhelmed and by now completely disoriented. With difficulty, I managed to get back to the bus. Still disoriented, I headed straight for the Zen Center. I stumbled up the stairs and plopped down on the couch in Suzuki's office. He greeted me in a friendly but mildly concerned manner and then asked what was going on. I told him about the statues. The spaciousness emanating from their eyes had pierced me to my core. There were no thoughts bubbling up in my mind, but my body felt awkward, unable to adjust to the sudden shift. Which statue? Suzuki said, which seemed totally irrelevant. But I told him where I had been in the museum and described the statues I saw there. "Let's have a cup of tea," he said. And I had a cup of tea with him. Nothing more was said. I went home. In the morning, I woke up and went to Zazen. And I was fine. I was fine. So we think we'd like to have an experience where we let go of all these movies. And we just experience great openness and great stillness. But we're not used to it. We're used to all this thinking, all this cogitation. And when it begins to go, our body can kind of go wacko, as mine did, because there's some fear there in the body. And then all Suzuki did was say, "Let's have a cup of tea," which was ground me in the present, in the physical. Because the spiritual is the physical, and the physical is the spiritual. So now I'd like to read from a section called Living Beyond the Fear Body. So it's because of the fear body, because in our head we have this body of fear, in our psyche we have this body of fear, that we can't just open up so easily. That it takes real devoted practice to open up. And that we get stuck on wanting the movie to be different, wanting that horror movie to go away and have a delightful movie instead. So since we get fixated on that, it really takes courage to stay on your cushion, to keep breathing, and to just have some faith that this too will pass. This too will pass. And if we do that, then we can begin to live beyond the fear body, just like Suzuki did. We can do it. We can all do it. See, when I knew him, he was not this great hero. He was just a regular, there were only a few of us there. He became more and more of a hero as he got older. He didn't really do anything different, but people sort of mythologized him. He was just, he was a wonderful teacher. My second teacher, Katagiri, who was my teacher in, Katagiri Roshi, my teacher in Minneapolis, used to go to San Francisco after Suzuki died. He went up there once, several times. He kept saying, "The Suzuki Roshi statues and pictures keep getting larger and larger every time I'm there." So that's what we do. Because of the fear body, we deify someone. Someone who is very spacious and still, but is still just a regular person. Just a regular person. So this chapter, Living Beyond the Fear Body. "Once, as I was driving Suzuki home after our Palo Alto sitting group, he asked if I would take him to an area in Hillsboro. He wanted to visit a woman who'd contacted him about Buddhism. He had never met this woman, but he felt he should go visit her. Well, I wasn't too happy about it because I was supposed to be in class, but I did it anyway." Actually, I was very happy about it. I would rather be with my teacher than be in class. His directions weren't good. We drove around for some time before we found the house. It was on a large, spacious estate in a wealthy suburb. Every time I tell the story, the estate gets larger and the suburb gets more wealthy. You know how that is? And nobody knows. I can say whatever I want. It's just me and him. "You stay here. I'll go up," he said. So I waited. But after only about 5 minutes, he came back. "How'd it go?" "Very interesting, but not woman I thought. Wrong woman." Then he started to laugh. "She thought I there to wash the windows," he exclaimed with delight. "But I didn't bring my squeegee," he chortled with great amusement. It was easy to see how she made the mistake. This is the Bay Area in the 1960s. And remember that there were many, well, you won't remember this, I don't even remember this, but you've read about it. The Japanese were all shipped to relocation camps during the World War II. Most of them lost everything. So growing up in Palo Alto, the only Japanese that I knew were gardeners, were cleaning women, were swimming pool cleaners, and Suzuki was the first Japanese person I met who was not a day laborer. So we So this is how this woman made this mistake. So when Suzuki went to the wrong house, it's sad but understandable that the woman thought he was there to wash her windows. The fear body would feel demeaned by this, because it's always concerned about what others think. Always concerned. We're always worried about what others think. Because we're afraid. We're afraid. We need others to validate us, to make us feel okay. But when we see through the fear body, we develop resiliency. As my teacher had. You can all develop this through your practice. And you will. You will if you stick with it. Suzuki did not feel demeaned. He lived beyond the fear body. He could accommodate himself to his environment without getting caught by it, because he was bigger than his environment. It was more as if he had pulled a practical joke on her. And then for the next year, he would joke with me about, he found a squeegee, and could we go back to that woman's house? He thought her windows were pretty dirty. But I didn't know who. He was just kidding me, and I didn't know who she was anyway. It was the wrong woman, right? And that was about the time that I, after starting the group at Stanford, I decided to move to San Francisco. And before I moved to San Francisco, I put a little ad in the Palo Alto Times about a sitting group in Palo Alto. Because there were only three or four of us, and we had to do all this cleaning every morning. And I thought, well, geez, we better get some more people so I won't have to get up at 4 a.m. and do all this cleaning. So my ad produced about 8 people. We had 8 new people, including a woman named Marion Derby, who had just gotten divorced from her doctor husband and seemed very interested in sitting. She sat with us once a week there in that graduate student's house. And then when I moved to San Francisco, she said to me, I have a garage in Los Altos, Suzuki can come down and sit in the garage. I said, well, I don't think you should be sitting in the garage. She said, no, we'll fix it up. We'll fix it up. So they fixed it up. I went to San Francisco and practiced up there. Then I went back to Stanford in Palo Alto. And then every morning I would commute to Marion's garage on my last year of Stanford. Every morning I was there, Monday through Friday, go to the garage, sit with her. And Suzuki came down once a week, and he gave the talks that are in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I heard him give those talks. They were only semi-intelligible. Marion was a great transcriber and editor, and so was Trudy Dixon. So when I saw the book, I thought, I didn't hear those talks. But they were in there. He did say all those things. It's just that there was all this other stuff that was, you had to just be patient. Be patient, because this was his second language. Second language. So let's see. The next one that I want to read is about the spell of desire. So the spell of desire. It's aspiration to sit is wonderful. We need that aspiration, but when it turns into a spell of desire, then we only want one kind of movie, the movie of great stillness, great silence. So that's what this is about. Remember adolescence? So I grew up in Palo Alto, and I had a girlfriend named Mickey when I was a senior in high school. And I pined away for her when I was not with her. She was my first girlfriend. And I would drive around her house at night, drive around her house in the neighborhood. I don't know what I was doing. But there I was, adolescent, driving around. Remember falling in love for the first time or even the second time? Any of you remember that? Being in that semi-conscious, dreamy, la-la land. Driving by Mickey's house over and over. When we meet someone we're attracted to, even their faults are appealing. And Suzuki's faults were appealing to me for that very reason. We're not seeing the person at all, though, when we do that. We're only seeing our own desire. Often in meditation, we're besieged by desire. One desire after another, they cycle through our mind endlessly. We're alone with them, with nothing to distract us and no way to fulfill them. We can only look at this endless parade of desires, this endless movie that just pulls us in all directions. And here we are sitting on the cushion, and we look so still. We look so Buddha-like. What did Bob Dylan say? If my thoughts, dreams could be seen, they'd put my mind in a guillotine. That's true for all you guys who are seeing. I know, because I've experienced it. That's the secret. One of the secrets. If you sit in meditation with devotion, you will have to see and endure your desires. After a while, we realize how irrelevant the object of our desire is. It is desire itself that perpetuates our suffering. We use desire to cover up all sorts of difficult emotions. If we're insecure, we set goals to prove our self-worth. We use goal setting to cover up deep hurts, painful memories. Avoiding difficult emotions perpetuates them. The cycle repeats itself, even with more intensity. Can you accept your desires graciously? When you sit on the cushion and see one desire after another, one movie frame after another, and feel how consuming each is, if you remain on your cushion, then you're graciously accepting them. You may not feel like that, like you are, but you are. When the bell rings and the desire, what happens to the desire when the bell rings? Usually it just suddenly woofs away, suddenly dissipates. And we recognize how little the desire actually means to us. Often it was just a temporary distraction from the pain or boredom that was coming up. Developing a gracious attitude toward our obsessive desires is what Zen practice is about. Seeing the nature of desire is the beginning of spiritual liberation. As Zen practitioners, we learn to carry our desires lightly, like butterflies alighting on our shoulders. I haven't seen many butterflies this trip. We used to have all this, many monarchs and many swallowtails. Maybe they're just hiding. We can watch, just watch the delightful butterfly. When it flies off, another will come, then another. If we don't get clingy or judgmental, we can enjoy them. If you learn nothing else from Zen practice, I hope you learn to hold your desires lightly. I hope you learn to just let the movie pass and not get tossed away by it. The next one I'm going to read is about, this was the 60s, right? So Suzuki Roshi was my main teacher, but there was a young guy named Bob Dylan, who was doing a lot of singing in San Francisco. Not that he was in San Francisco. So, so this section is my love minus zero mantra. After my first year of Zen practice, the austerity of sitting still and doing nothing did not seem to be working for me anymore. Even Suzuki Roshi was not working for me, though I kept sitting with him every morning and evening. To make the early morning meditation, I sometimes stayed up all night. So I was a college student. I was used to going to bed at 1 or 1 a.m., so it was much easier to stay up till 5 than to have to actually go to bed and go to sleep. I sat in an all-night diner, drinking coffee and staring out the window into the fog and darkness until it was time to go to the Zen Center. This was about the time Bob Dylan came out with the album Bringing It All Back Home. Anybody remember that album? Oh, one person does. Anybody else? Oh, another person. No, two more people. Three more people. Okay. Four lines from two verses in the song Love Minus Zero, No Limit became my mantra. My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure, and that failure is no success at all. The first line, my love, she speaks like silence, was about my teacher. Sensei seemed to speak like silence. Silence went with him wherever he went. It wasn't a rigid, heavy, reverent kind of silence. It was light and spacious, a brilliant silence, an ordinary silence. I was romanced by that silence. I sensed something wonderful in it and was drawn to it. I'm still romanced by that silence, but not by the silence of any one person, by the silence that's present in all beings. After almost 50 years, I'm still awed by the great silence that surrounds and imbues everything. Next phrase, without our ideals or violence. One reason practice became so hard for me was that I had an ideal I was clinging to. My ideal was that I should do Zen practice with grace. but I was stumbling through it with no grace at all. Ideals are frequently about should and shouldn't. They have nothing to do with what's actually going on. Too often they provoke violent thoughts. We are limited and bullied by them. Just showing up each morning and evening was all I needed to do. I didn't need to compare my Zen practice with some ideal. The more rigidly idealistic we are, the more violent we become on the inside. Look at all of the religious wars that have been going on for how many hundreds of years, in Buddhist countries as well. Clinging to the ideal, this is the way it should be. Look at all the patriotic wars. This is the way it should be. This is the one true way. So without ideals or violence, this great stillness is always manifesting itself. That doesn't mean we don't need ideals, but we shouldn't get stuck on them. We can develop resilience, real resilience. I'm just going to read a couple more, and then it'll be time for some conversation, okay? The next one is entitled Suzuki Roshi's Counterculture. Eight 800 years after Dogen, Suzuki Roshi breathed new life into Buddha's original counterculture. So Buddha developed a very quiet counterculture in India. Quiet because he didn't get in trouble like Jesus did. But he welcomed people from all castes to sit with him, to practice with him. And this was very unorthodox. My daughter-in-law is Indian, and she says, even now, the caste system is very, very important in India. And there, she said to me that, well, it's not 6 castes, there are 18 castes or something, I don't remember. And she said, it's too bad because the people in the lower castes are treated so poorly. But Buddha developed a counterculture. He said, no, I'm not into that. We're all interdependent, including the frogs and the sky. We're all interdependent. We're all equal. We're all equal. Equally interdependent. So he developed this counterculture. Similarly, a counterculture, when Zen started in China, it was originally a counterculture. It was counter to the dominant Confucian culture and even the devotional Buddhist culture that was taking root. When Dogen, our Japanese founder, went to China, he was also looking for a different way of doing things because he thought Japanese Buddhism was very esoteric, and there were very few people who were tapping into this wonderful stillness. So this history of countercultures, Suzuki was just part of. Like Dogen, Suzuki, and he actually talked to me about this when I was a young man, felt that Buddhism in Japan had taken on a corpus of fear, although he did not use corpus. He did not use corpus. He came to America seeking an enclave of fresh ground to cultivate. He discovered a wellspring, but it was unlike anything he could have imagined. On November 13, 1967, I don't know how many of you were born before that time, but some of you, to raise money to buy Tassajara, we organized a Zenefit held in the Avalon Ballroom in San Francisco. The concert featured performances by The Grateful Dead, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and Janis Joplin, artists who have since become legendary. And after I did my first talk on this book, someone sent me online the poster from the Zenefit, the 1967 Zenefit. And it listed all the groups, but it didn't list Janis Joplin. And I said to my friend, why is Janis Joplin not in it? And they said, oh, she was just part of the Big Brother and the Holding Company. So there you go. I didn't usually go to the Haight-Ashbury district because it wasn't my scene, but I went to the Zenefit. The auditorium was full. Light effects emanated from strobe lights and lasers mounted throughout the theater. Pungent odors filled the air. People were dressed or undressed in an amazing variety of regalia. And the huge sounds of 60s rock boomed from the stage. My second teacher, Katagiri Sensei, had been in the United States for only 2 years at that time. He was reserved, quiet, and a very gentle presence. I remember seeing him standing anxiously in the shadows, half hidden, and looking quite out of sorts and unsettled in that crazy environment. He looked as if he wanted to run away. I'm sure he did. Suzuki had already been in San Francisco for about 8 years, so he'd learned about us. He'd learned about us, and he'd learned how to work with us, and we got along very well with him. So he also been doing this practice for many more years in Katagiri Roshi. He's doing this practice for 30 more years. This resiliency practice. Zazen is resiliency practice. And I know often you'd feel like it's the opposite. You feel like it's just, you're just frozen on the cushion, you don't improve, you just have the same movies over and over again. But if you stay with it, with your open heart and your kind aspiration, you do develop resilience. You just do. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. The block of ice that defines you melts into water, and it freezes up again sometimes. But that's okay. We all freeze sometimes. Frozen water is good too, but we should know about melted water. Suzuki was older, and he'd been doing resiliency practice for years and years. He sat in the front row of the theater, with lights flashing on him from all directions. What a memorable sight. Surrounded by utter chaos, he was completely relaxed and seemed totally in his element. He was looking around, smiling, taking it all in. I think he was grooving on the whole thing. Finally, the last performer, the amazing blues singer Janis Joplin, took the stage. I worked in the post office at this time, in the basement of the San Francisco post office, and as a mail handler, and two of the guys that I worked with were in love with Janis. I mean, really in love with her, just from listening to her and watching her. She gave it her all after talking about shedding the fear of body. In front of 1,000 people, she bared her heart and soul in a classic Janis performance. Then it was time for Suzuki to say something to the crowd. The auditorium grew silent as he crossed the microphone. When he spoke, his voice was calm and warm. At first, I think your way very different from ours, but now I see not so different, not so different. The crowd roared. Suzuki was touched by Janice's ability to shed her fear body and give her whole heart to others. People responded to her in a visceral way. Janis imbibed the music. We need to imbibe this practice, imbibe the stillness that's all already here. We'll never get it through our thinking, but just by sitting here with wholehearted attention, and even if our mind is wandering, just coming back, we begin to imbibe it. Janis imbibed the music. It seemed to come from the ground of her being, but she didn't have a practice that cultivated resiliency. She could bare her soul on stage in front of people, but privately her life was tragic. Less than 3 years after the Zenefit, she was dead. So this counterculture that Suzuki Roshi encountered was not the one he thought he was going to encounter. I don't think any of you, I know Wanda's read it, have any of you read the book Crooked Cucumber about Suzuki's life? Two or three? Oh, a few of you have, of course. Less has. So he met when he was a young man, and he was first a teacher, he met a woman named Miss Ransom, who taught him English and he taught her Japanese. She was British, but he didn't know the difference between British and the U.S., and he sure didn't know the difference between British and San Francisco, U.S. in the 60s, right? So he really wanted to come to the U.S. Because she was really interested in sitting, and very few people in Japan were. Miss Ransom was. And he liked Miss Ransom. They had tea together at 3 o'clock every afternoon. She was very restrained. She was very moderate. He thought the U.S. would just be wonderful. It would be a wonderful place of disciplined modesty with well-regulated practice. Well, what did he encounter? What did he encounter? Undisciplined, immodest, no regulation. That was what we were up to. But we wanted, we believed, some of us had taken acid. I hadn't taken it, but and we believed there was a stillness inside that we could all tap into, and we saw that he could do it naturally. So we stayed in practice with him and gradually disciplined ourselves, gradually became modest, and gradually tapped into the same stillness that you guys can all tap into under your the leadership of your teacher. So I'm going to do one more at the end of the book, and then we'll have a little time for questions, I'm sure, or comments, or whatever. Not long after I had my Satori experience at Tassajara Zen Monastery, I went in for Dokusan with Suzuki, one-to-one with Suzuki. He looked at my shoes strewn by the door where I had kicked them off. They were dirty and disheveled. His were tidy and placed carefully side by side. This book says I had never noticed that before, but I couldn't have been that stupid. Wanda says that I said that. Well, maybe I was. I had never noticed that before. He looked at my shoes, he looked at me, and he said, "Now that you are so-called enlightened, it's time to take care of those." And he glanced at my shoes. I wasn't too interested in my shoes. Zen was an opportunity to transcend the physical, to experience something beyond ordinary. I was also frustrated by Suzuki's reluctance to give us the real stuff. What did my shoes have to do with emptiness? What did my shoes have to do with spaciousness? However, we stay connected to the world through what we do, not what we think. Suzuki said, "There are no enlightened people, there's only enlightened activity. There are no enlightened people, there's only enlightened activity." It's important that we be fully engaged in each of our activities. Today, people frequently come into Doksan one-to-ones with me to talk about with their ideas about Zen with me. I don't want to be rude, so I listen, but I'm not very interested in that. The bigger question is, what are you going to do, and how are you going to live? Life is short, you guys. It's really short. What are you going to do with your short time here? What do you really want to do in your heart of hearts, your short time here? When Ram Dass asked his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, "How can I be enlightened?" Baba answered, "Love people, feed people, love people." Later, Ram Dass went back and asked, "But what's the best path to awakening?" Baba said, "Feed people, love people, feed people." So Ram Dass, some of you know, helped to establish the Seva community in the United States based on Baba's teachings. And it completely fell apart. It was complete chaos. And Ram Dass went back to India to see his teacher a third time after feeling like he totally failed. And he asked Baba, "What's the best technique for establishing community?" Baba said, "Love people, feed people, love people." So it's our actions, moment to moment. Can we really be with each other? Can be with each other in a wholehearted way? Can we be with the crickets, with the light, with our sandals, in a genuine, intimate way? We can. We can. And when the movie gets so intense, we can just see right through the movie to this activity we're doing. We don't have to be tossed away by it. Never have to be tossed away, because there's always an activity of engaging for us, whatever we're doing, engaging. So I'm going to finish with a famous quote by Dogen: to study the way is to study the self. So on our cushions, we're studying the self. Not through our head, but just looking at it. Just looking at each frame of the movie without analyzing it. Because it's telling us something about our neediness, about our fear body, about our regrets, about our sadnesses. And it's something we can just see. Just see and not be captivated by it, not be overwhelmed by it. So when we study the self, we forget the self. When we take care of our shoes by the door, we don't think about the self, we just think about, oh, how nice it is to straighten them. How nice it is to take the mud off them. And to forget the self is to be intimate with all life. To feed people, to love people, to feed people. So we start this practice by studying the small self, looking at the small self. Eventually we meet our true boundaryless self. And love arises naturally, you guys, don't you think? From the ground of being, which is the ground of our little being. It's the ground of all being. Our little frightened being is still the same ground of all being. Pretty cool, isn't it? Pretty lucky, aren't we? To forget the self is to be intimate with all life. In Buddha's world, all life includes everything, from the cosmos to the marrow. And that's about what I want to say for tonight. So I'll be glad to entertain any questions that you have. Or listen to any comments that anyone has about anything. Yes?
So what took you from San Francisco to Minnesota?
Yeah, it's a good question. My wife, who followed me, kept asking me that for 10 years and finally gave up. But I was talking to her the other night on the phone and I said, Linda, you know, it's really wonderful out here. I said, it's nicer here than Minnesota. And she said, And I said, you know, it hasn't been spoiled by Silicon Valley. You know, the ocean's still here, the Santa Cruz Mountains are still here, and there are wonderful outdoor cafes. And she said, And I said, but we went. And she said, yeah, I wasn't so confident then. I followed you, but I'm not following you anymore. That's my wife for 49 and a half years. So it was my idea to go. It seemed like all you guys were coming in and taking up space. So it was good to go someplace else. And I had been in northern Minnesota as a small boy, and I had been canoeing on Lake Superior, and I had an aunt who was beloved to me, who lived on the north shore of Lake Superior. And I was a counterculture guy, so I thought, oh, that's the place to go. That's the place to go. Oh, and once I got there, you know, I had kids, and, you know, then Katagiri showed up. I thought, wow, talk about a synchronicity. I thought I'd gotten away from Zen. And after I'd been there for about a year, he showed up. He'd been my teacher here in San Francisco, my assistant teacher. I thought, oh, I can't escape. So this is a profound synchronicity. When I say that to my wife, she says, oh, yeah, right. Right. That's my answer. Anybody else? Anything else? Yeah.
Thank you for your words and for bringing Suzuki Roshi alive to us.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Yes. It's interesting how these things sort of evolve, isn't there? Isn't it? You know, there are three or four people who would come, and they usually fell asleep in our graduate student's house, and they usually fell asleep. And the graduate student didn't even come down. And there he was. And so he was kind of a missionary, but he wasn't a missionary who said, do it my way. He was a missionary who connected with us and led us into ourselves so we could discover the same peace that he knew intimately. We were lucky. I was like Forrest Gump. I know I was like Forrest Gump. Cool. Cool. Yeah.
Levity.
Pardon?
Levity.
Levity.
And resilience and Zen. Can you talk about those?
Levity and resilience in Zen. Can I talk about those? Oh, yes, I can talk about those. Well, in India, monks were not supposed to laugh. There was a hierarchy of humor, and if you were going to be a profound monk, you would just give a little Buddha smile. But it was considered very gauche to laugh. Well, Zen, the counterculture that started in China with Han Shan and Shi Te and many of these guys, it was raucous laughter. Because when we let go of worrying about things, we just laugh at lots of stuff. We laugh at ourselves, we laugh at each other, we laugh at the crickets. We just enjoy our lives. We just enjoy our lives. And that's part of resiliency. That's part of resiliency. But this happens on its own. You can't force it. If you get a bit expectation, a big ideal, then it happens on its own through just your wholehearted desire to manifest this great silence moment to moment and regular sitting. When I first met Suzuki, after I told him about this experience I'd had, this enlightenment experience in Utah. Remember that one I told you at the very beginning? And I thought, oh, I finally found the Zen teacher. He's going to think, wow. I mean, you know, wow. So I told him about the whole experience. You know, I went into more detail even than with you guys. I mean, here's a Zen master. You know, I'm going to impress him. Well, no, I didn't really want to impress him. I just wanted some affirmation. You know, we always want affirmation from others because we feel insecure. So I wanted affirmation. And so I told him about the experience, and he said, well, that's very good, but it's not Zen. And I thought, oh, he doesn't understand my English. he needs English lessons. But he understood my English. He understood my English. Because I was attaching to a special experience that I had, which was a memory, which I was carrying around with me as if I was some special dude, right? Well, I had been a special dude, and I wanted to be a special dude again. And he then took me into the little zendo and said, sit on one of these black cushions. I'll show you how. I said, okay. And I said, how often should I do it? He said, every morning and every night. So I just started doing it. Stupid. Every morning and every night. Of course, this was not 2015 when we have iPhones and iPads and work 8 hours a week. The times were different then. It was more conducive. And we were in the counterculture. We'd given all that other stuff up. So we could sit 7-day retreats. We could go to Tassajara for 2 months or 3 months. The culture has changed. But you can do it. You can do it in this culture too. And everybody, it's been the same problem for 2,500 years of finding the right context to have sacred time for yourself, still time for yourself, on a daily basis so that you can soak into this stillness that's always here. Maybe that's enough. So thank you very much. And especially Les, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dick, for coming all this way to share your experience with us and hope everybody get a little bit in touch with our